Thank you, Roberta. It's nice to be back in Warwick, even if I'm sort of slightly scared about these informal seminars. One never knows where one is going to go. I really wanted to do two things. One is what I wanted to do, and the second is what you wanted me to do. But luckily, I think they can be combined quite nicely. And what I was asked to do originally was talk about the development of the history of medicine. In other words, the historiography of the history of medicine. And the second question I was asked to look at was what is the place of classics, classical medicine, early modern medicine, indeed one can almost say 19th century medicine, in the history of medicine today. And I think one can easily combine them for one very simple reason, which is that until 20, 30, 40, certainly 40 years ago, both the classical tradition, Renaissance medicine and so on, formed the very basis of the teaching, the study of the history of medicine. So that makes it, in one sense, easy. But I think I'm going to start with a game. I'm going to ask you questions to which I expect the answer to be no. And the reason will appear in a moment. And what I'm going to do is just, I want you to raise your hand if you've ever heard of a particular medical historian, and secondly, if you've ever read any of that particular medical historian. So we're going to start Roy Porter. Raise your hand if you've heard of Roy Porter. If you've ever read anything by Roy Porter. Good. Charles Webster. Ofsi Temkin. Read anything by Temkin? Good. Henry Ernst Sigerist. Read anything? You're doing well. I'm going to disqualify Roberta. There's something coming for you. Right, Noel Pointer. Noel Pointer, read anything? Kenneth Keel, exactly. Charles Singer, read anything? And finally, John Friend.
No.
Good. Okay. Right, well, let's play the game with historians, proper historians, let's say. Bourdieu, good. Read anything? That's... this is not a confession session. There's a whole point. Like, Foucault. Read anything? Oh, good. Okay. Fernand Braudel. Read anything? Good. Mark Bloch. Read anything? It gets. G.M. Young. Thomas Macaulay. Better. The reason I'm asking these questions is really to make a very simple point, which is that the historians of two generations ago, i.e. the historians who were famous in my youth, the people who were thought to be the leading historians of the period, have largely forgotten. All the same thing goes for most historians. G.M. Young, whose name I would appear to be totally known, unknown, was the great historian of Victorian England, and his name would have been familiar to anybody writing certainly until the 1950s. He's totally forgotten. That's something that we should always bear in mind when you're looking at the history of a particular subject. Very few historians outlast their own generation, and even a very tiny percentage are thought worth rereading a century later. And there's some obvious reasons. It's shifts in interest, shifts in historiography, shifts in the way we look at the world. Just take a very simple example. Globalization is really to do with Starbucks, as well as to do with history. And 20 years ago, and in some places even today, it was called tropical medicine or colonial medicine. It's now called globalization. It's that chain, the interest in that, has been as much to do with factors completely outside the realm of history, and whereas there are other things which have developed within history. New methods, demography, which became very important in the 1970s, feminist historiography, which is really the 1980s, and so on. And all these have changed. And also how historians write, the way in which they write history, has had a major impact on the way we think about what history should be. Those great narrative histories, Gibbon and Macaulay, are less in favour today, not entirely excluded, but we tend not to think in that sort of terms. The history of medicine is also an interesting example of something, particularly a subject that can have both what we might describe as an internal and an external aspect. One should remember that history in general, the history writing in general, was done by contemporaries or near contemporaries, almost down to the 18th, 19th century. And history as an academic subject was invented not for history, but for diplomacy. The first chairs of history in this country, in France, were there to teach diplomats. They had a practical purpose. And history of medicine, in a sense, has that also as one of its major components, that history of medicine is there to teach, in some way, to teach doctors. And that's got a, really had a problem. It's a problem because it's even easier to see history coming from a dim and distant past of 1900, coming through to the modern period. That notion is very much there, that, if you like, history is the development of medicine, and with it that notion that the only people who can write about the history of medicine are those people who are medically qualified. Just as you might say the only people who should write about the history of railways are people who've been employed by the railways, and the history of law is written by lawyers. And for many, 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 many years, it was argued that you needed to be medically qualified in order to be a medical historian. Now, my view is different from that, and I think that view in many ways has been pushed to one side with the development of the social history of medicine. But I still believe that you can't be a proper medical historian unless you can communicate with doctors, the medical profession, and unless you know something about how medicine is practiced. That, to me, has always been the great joy of being a medical historian, because I've been, if you like, involved with medics, a very queer bunch indeed, and with historians. And Kenneth Keel, who is a great friend of mine, said to me he didn't think anybody should write about the history of medicine unless at some point in their life they'd been in the position of knowing what it was like to make a decision about somebody in front of them who was ill. And he said, you have no idea what it is like faced with the decision. What's wrong with this person? What am I going to do? And he said, if you have that, in his view, it affected the whole way you thought about medicine. Now, I'm not medically qualified, but I actually have had three experiences of having to deal with that situation, so I feel myself slightly qualified. I have even had the wonderful experience of having my clinical notes handed to me by the consultant saying, Of course, you're a doctor. Can you examine this medical student when he comes in? Just say, ask him what you should have for your treatment. And of course, the medical student was a very good one, and he said, oh, you're well on the way to recovery, we don't need to do it. So I didn't know whether to give him marks for truth or tact. But this sort of overlap in the history of medicine is what seems to me to make it fascinating. And it means that it opens up a whole range of possibilities. And one, this is what I think is in some ways difficult, because the more professional we become as medical historians, the easier it is to have sort of turf wars. You've got to do this, you've got to study that, you've got to do this. You can't be a medical historian if you don't know about clinical medicine. You can't be a medical historian unless you're interested in the social history of medicine, etc. And these turf wars, it seems to me, are rather ridiculous, because we're in a very, very broad church. But now, to go back to your question, what about where do we fit the classics? Right. Does anybody know here, we have classicists, what is the earliest history of medicine, the earliest notice we have of a history of medicine that we can say was written as history? That is to say, writing the past to describe what had gone before. Any idea?
Celsus?
Nope. It's about at least 220 BC.
Oh.
And there was a doctor who ended up being murdered, who was an Alexandrian royal physician, who wrote a book called The Genealogy of Medicine, in which he traced the history of medicine. Okay, what's the surviving earliest fragments that we could say are the historical analysis of any part of medicine? Any idea when that is? Well, that's 330 BC. That's the Aristotle, the fragments ascribed to Aristotle, listing the names and ideas of earlier doctors. And now for other, we move on. What's the earliest surviving history of medicine which has the title in it, history? Any idea? Good. That's about 880. It's an Arabic text called The History of the Physicians. So history of medicine has been going on for a long, 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 long while. And there are really two sorts of this in the early stage. One is just a list of genealogy. Who taught who? I taught Roberto, and so on. Yeah. And they drew up a list of names going back not just to Hippocrates, but going back to Asclepius, and wonderful exotic names. A list of where we began. Lists of names. Lists of groups of followers. This is what you find in Celsus. This is what you find in late antiquity. This is what you find in the Middle Ages. And I published a year ago a wonderful Latin text based on the Hebrew, which was a history of medicine that began with Noah, and it included, among other things, Asclepius, who went with 40 Macedonian sages to the Garden of Eden, which is in Egypt, which is in India, and where, as he reached out to touch the tree of knowledge, St. Michael, the angel, struck him and the 40 sages dead. At which point medicine disappeared for 857 years until Hippocrates comes along. And this is a Jewish legend circulating in about 400 AD. It explains why you have different types of medicine, different groups of people, the Babylonians, the Egyptians, the Macedonians, the Indians all contribute to medicine, but it is revived by Hippocrates and continues in a nice line until Galen of Cappadocia. Why Cappadocia? It's very strange. And this is a history written by the Jews, somebody Jewish, translated or rewritten in Latin and circulating in North Italy in 1400. It's an attempt to go back to explain where we came from. The other type of history is that which Aelian has already mentioned, is Cornelius Celsus, a Roman author, 1st century AD, who has a wonderful preface explaining for the benefit of non-medics what medicine is about. And his Latin account became important in Western Europe from about 1450. His near contemporary is another author, a general author called Pliny, and you've got the list of names on the handout and dates. And Pliny writes the most important account of medicine ever written. And it tells you what doctors are like. What they're crooks, they're charlatans, they're sex maniacs, they murder their patients, the Hippocratic Oath is a conspiracy against patients, and it's all, doctors are the greatest corruptors of morals out. Wonderfully written, very famous, and it affected the whole conception of medicine for centuries, because it suggested that doctors are pretty deceitful, immoral, etc., etc. Pliny's account, that of Celsus, are for the general public. And this is where we come to the Arabs, because the Arabs, as most many of you know, take over notions from the Greeks. And they take over from, with Isaac ibn Hanan's History of Physicians, they take over some of the Greek material, but they turn it into two different directions. The first is that they are interested in, if you like, who people were. Who are these people? Who are Hippocrates, Galen? Who are these names? And so they create their own histories, you can say their own myths, by trying to explain who these people are. For a general public, some of them actually use ancient Greek texts. Simon Swain has written about the biography of Galen in Arabic, in which some of the people go back and read texts which are no longer available to us. But they do it in a context of general learning, polite letters. The sort of thing, in German, until the end of the 19th century, you used to have something which was called a conversations lexicon. A lexicon of things that you might need for polite conversation. And this is where the Arabic tradition comes in. It's things you might need at a dinner party. Say, did you know the story about? Did you know the story about how Hippocrates murdered Galen? And so on. It's polite learning for a dinner party. It isn't history in our sense of the word, but it became, in the Middle Ages, in Western Europe, the notion of what the history of medicine is about. A nice series, either of lists of names, or pretty stories, lovely stories about, in particular, Hippocrates, Galen, but also some of the unfamiliar authors who were turned into personalities, and some familiar ones. Plato, for instance, is included in this sort of list, and those of you who are maybe classicists may be unaware that Plato was a man prone to weeping and going off into the desert to weep, where he could be found by his students because they could hear him crying a mile off. I don't know where that comes from, but it's the sort of story that you told at a dinner party. The history of medicine really begins probably, one could say, in the 15th century, when you begin to get the new humanists looking at Pliny, looking at Celsus in the 15th century Italy, and creating a history of medicine to go to, if you like, justify the new humanist medicine. It's based, to start with, on Latin sources. It's based on Celsus. It's based on Isidore of Seville. Greek sources appear about 1500, a man called Bartolotti. And from then on, we get the Greek material taking over. and in particular Galen. And this forms the basis, then, for what history of medicine is about. It is the classics. We forget the Middle Ages. It's the classics which leads up to the present, and we look at this in two different ways. The first is the medical way. And here my example is a man on your sheet called Mercuriale, wonderfully learned, who wrote a book called De Arte Gymnastica, on the art of physical exercise, and whose first book is the biggest account of ancient exercise, ancient amphitheatres, palaestra, written up to that point. It's a survey of ancient athletics for the benefit, to provide the basis for modern doctors saying, this is what you should use from the past. So we have doctors using that historical material to illustrate their own practice. On the other hand, we then get the generalists, people who are writing about the history of medicine as things that you ought to know about. A man called Theodor Zwinger, who was professor in Basel, wrote, if that's the right word, produced in 30-some volumes, a book called The Theatre of Human Life. All human life is there. So if you do want to find out details of famous doctors, famous poisoners, famous murderers, doctors who had adultery with their female patients, doctors who had sex with their male patients, etc., etc., it's all in Zwinger. It's all carefully lined up. So if you wanted to use this as polite conversation, it's all there. And another example is a French man called André Tiracot, who wrote a huge book that thick called On Nobility. It's a lawyer's book. And the last book is about how you become a modern noble. But most of the book is taken up with social history. There are 150 pages on the nobility of the art of medicine, taken from Celsus and Pliny and so on, listing all the great names, all the kings, all the princes, all the nobles who had an interest in medicine, and showing that nobility matters. The doctors are nobles, really, as are lawyers. And this sort of tradition continues. John Friend, whom I mentioned, wrote a history of medicine in English. It's the first history of medicine in English. And he and his friend Richard Mead, in the early part of the 18th century, indulge in a wonderful argument about the status of Roman doctors. Were they slaves or were they not? And of course, the physicians are very keen to show that doctors are not slaves. And Mead, who was president of the Royal College of Physicians, wrote at great length, saying the word slave here is merely metaphorical. Libertus does not mean freed man, but it means a free man. And that's what we are as doctors. And one may smile, not least when a fellow of Trinity College, Cambridge, managed to produce yet more texts, epigraphic texts, showing slave doctors, and showing that some doctors, at any rate, were definitely not free. But the idea that you use the past to help the present, that you go back into history to collect material for your present concern, is there right through until, well, the middle years of the 19th century. Some of the people who practice this are wonderfully learned, amazingly learned. One of the earliest studies of Arabic medicine is by a professor called Johann Heinrich Schulz in the 18th century, who became a fellow of the Academy of, well, the early fellows of the Academy of St. Petersburg. Wonderfully learned man. And he was succeeded in Halle, which is where he taught, by a man with a wonderful name, which was Johann Kurt Heinrich Polycarp Sprengel, who wrote what was the standard history of medicine for 30 years, 40 years. And it was called A Pragmatic History of Medicine. Why pragmatic? First of all, it's against philosophy. But more importantly, It's against those people who think writing about history is simply listing names and books, what they called in the 18th century a literary history. Sprengel says history of medicine matters because it gives you information about your present day work as a doctor. And he's got colleagues, Gruner, and one might note that the standard works of the edition of Hippocrates by Littré, the standard edition of Galen by Carl Gottlob Kuhn, the famous translations into English of Hippocrates and Paul of Aegina by Francis Adams were all written for the benefit of modern doctors, to provide them with information that they might otherwise not have. This is the 1820s. By 1850, the situation has changed drastically. It's changed in history because we have people going back in larger quantities, looking at the archives, looking at documents, and suddenly, and it happens within roughly 20 years, historians of medicine stop really trying to look at the past to help the present, at least directly. They go into the archives. They go and look at manuscripts. They rediscover the Middle Ages. I think that's the best way of putting it. And the leading figure is a man, perhaps it's unfair to call him the leading figure because there were people before him. But the dominant figure at the end of the 19th century is a man called Karl Sudhoff, who was the professor of history of medicine at Leipzig. He was a local doctor near Dusseldorf. But Sudhoff is the man who professionalized history of medicine from 1890, right, so he died late 1930s. But what he did, he established an institute, he established journals, he established bibliographies, he established medical museums, and in a sense, he professionalized the field. He was a frightening man. He did actually sleep in his office from time to time. But he professionalized it, and in a sense, gave history of medicine a new place in the university. And his example is followed elsewhere in Germany. It had been preceded in Vienna, Würzburg, other places. In a sense, it removed history of medicine from direct medicine. There's one exception to this, and that is epidemic disease, where the history of epidemic disease forms part of medical training until the end of the 19th century. Because if you're looking at epidemics, how do you get the information? What sort of information are you looking for? And for many of the people working in epidemiology, the appropriate information comes in historical texts. And a man called Heinrich Heise, who was professor in Berlin for many years, was, if you like, the leading figure in this. Understudied. There's very little on him. But his books were extremely important. And his book is called The History of Medicine and Epidemic Disease, because until the end of the 19th century, that was the way in which you found out information about epidemic disease. Russian scholars looked at medieval Islamic material because that was good, not quite medieval, but 15th, 16th century Islamic material from the Caucasus, because that told you about what diseases you would find in the Russian Empire. It was important for epidemic disease. Going back to Leipzig, became the model for history of medicine in the United States. Sigalist, who was a pupil of, of Sudhoff, but his successor, became the first professor of history of medicine at Baltimore. Temkin was Sigalist's assistant. Ludwig Edelstein, the classicist, studied for a while in Leipzig. In this country, Walter Pagel, whose father had been Privatdozent in the history of medicine in Berlin, he studied in Leipzig, came to England in the 30s as a refugee, and was instrumental, among other, with Joe Needham and others, in setting up courses, lectures in the history of science and medicine in Cambridge, which was the first time that one had organised courses. Charles Singer regarded Sudhoff as his sort of hero, and Sudhoff's methodology, if you like, became the standard. It was a history of medicine which started with the Greeks, with perhaps a nod to Egypt and Babylonia, and went through until the present. It was a tradition, a living tradition, so to speak, and this was what was taught, and this was what it was. It was medicine, the history of medicine for doctors, and it was supported by new societies, some of which still exist today. The Osler Club in London, for instance, the Royal Society of Medicine historical section in this country, the Apothecaries Society in London. But it was confined to what one might call amateur societies, interested in, if you like, their own history and in the history of their institutions. So you have wonderful histories of things like St. Bartholomew's Hospital by Sir Norman Moore, sometime surgeon to King George V. Elite physicians, elite surgeons, writing their history. This continued until the 1960s, probably. Noel Poynter was the head of the Wellcome Library, and he begins, if you like, I think, organising serious courses in history of medicine in the 1960s with the Society of Apothecaries. He was assisted by Kenneth Keel, who was one of the world experts on the Leonardo drawings, and who Keel and Poynter wrote a short history of medicine, published by what is an unlikely firm of Mills and Boone. But there were scientific publishers before they turned to sex. Not much difference. But Poynter established the Wellcome as the centre in London. It had not been a centre. It had been built up as a museum, but the Wellcome Drug Company was nearly bankrupt and didn't start making money until the 1960s. And the Wellcome Library remained hardly used. The Wellcome Museum was small, and Poynter wanted to establish the history of medicine, and he was a major entrepreneur in the history of medicine, and his successor as director, Edwin Clark, wanted to turn history of medicine to something more professional, that is to say, with professional standards, and that's where I come in a sense, because in the 1970s, the Wellcome starts setting up units for the history of medicine in originally Edinburgh, London, Cambridge, Oxford is later, Manchester is slightly later, setting up groups of young teachers to teach the history of medicine to whoever, mostly in medical schools. And we came from different backgrounds. One group, which is Andrew Weir, Janet Brown, Andrew Cunningham, came through history of science. They've been taught by Rupert Hall at Imperial. Bob Young came from sociology. Some came from medicine. Some came from a range of different specialties. I came from classics, so to speak. And so you suddenly had a group of people teaching medical students who came from very different backgrounds. And the question is, what do you teach? And the answer is very simple. And I give you the words of my head of department when I was appointed. I'm not bothered what you teach, as long as it interests them. Go away and come back in 5 years. How different these days. And in a sense, that's what we did. Roy Porter joined us 3 years later. But the aim, because you had a variety of backgrounds, you came in with different skills, with different attitudes, but all with the, if you like, the missionary aim of trying to interest people in the history of medicine. The major development after that has been, if you like, the growth of social history of medicine, which was there in the 1960s. I studied sociology for a while, and I was one of the people who was, if you like, studying history and sociology. My friend Helen King studied anthropology and classics, one of the first people to do that degree in London. So there were people who were starting in the 60s and early 70s with a, if you like, a social bias, and the Society for the Social History of Medicine was founded with people, largely with my people from London, from the Wellcome and elsewhere, to bring in doctors with an interest in the society, an interest in the social forces that influence medicine. Of course, from then on, the social history of medicine has come to dominate, at any rate, the UK, less so in Germany, simply because medical history is, for the most part, still taught within the medical faculty. And you cannot be a senior professor in an institute in the history of medicine in Germany without being medically qualified. So the best and most famous historians of medicine may very well not be the head of department, simply because they're not medically qualified. But since the 70s, we've had more social history of medicine, and we've also had a wider breakdown in understanding what history is about. It came first in the States. If you look at publications in the Bulletin of the History of Medicine, until 1970, probably two-thirds were to do with medicine before the year 1850, maybe more than that. The figure today is much, much less. But think of what history is taught in schools. It's very, very bitty, and it's not necessarily joined-up history. In the States, in many parts of the world, there isn't that same, if you like, commitment to a Western European tradition of medicine. All of which presents problems for anybody who works on non-modern medicine, however that is defined. My feeling is, in one sense, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter in the sense that if one believes that you've got something to say, and that you've got something to tell whoever your students are, whether you're talking about the history of ideas or the history of society, that's fine. Where it does matter is having administrators who tick boxes and say, we've got to have somebody who works on X, because that's what we think is central. That's turf wars. And that's the one thing that worries me. But against this, anybody who, I think, history of medicine, I think, should be a broad subject, simply because, A, it affects all of us, whether we're doctors or patients, and B, because I think on the medical side, there's so much that the non-medic can learn. And so my view is we've lost that absolute commitment to a long, nice line of tradition going back to Hippocrates and coming almost unbroken down to probably now the end of the 19th century. As yet, we haven't got anything in its place. But that's also an opportunity.